How lucky are we living in a country where you choose where you live, criticise the government, feel safe? Not so in dictatorships, and not so where autocrats get elected. It's common to hear in general chit-chat people saying, oh yes, I'm in favour of democracy. And on my grumpier days, I want to say, what do you mean by that? Do you mean you're just happy with whoever wins the election and that's it? Because you and I know that democracy is a lot more than that. It's checks and balances on the government, an independent judiciary, freedom of the press, and on it goes. So what happens when someone is democratically elected then starts to undermine the checks and balances? Autocrats who get elected, what happens? To help us with that, I'm talking to Joshua Kurlancic. He is a Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Joshua Kurlancic, welcome back to Counterpoint.
Thanks again for having me.
Tell us, what is the point you want to make here about democracies that have autocrats elected?
A lot of them are sort of autocratic-leaning populists. If you think about people like the president of Turkey or the president of the Philippines or of
Hungary.
Yeah, he's not the president, but yeah, Hungary and the new incoming president of Brazil, is that, one, I think it's a much different situation than an actual complete autocracy, like a situation like China or North Korea, where the legitimacy is really hard to determine where it comes from. And the people can't actually claim they were elected. Here you have people who actually were elected and then undermine the democratic system in various ways, in ways that can actually make it harder for them to be pushed out of power, unelected, or rejected at the ballot box. But then the second point, if your democracy has been degraded or undermined by these types of folks, it's actually harder in some ways to recover, perhaps impossible. We don't really know that. Silvio Berlusconi was another good example. Then if you were making a transition from an outright authoritarian regime, of course, life's really bad under an authoritarian regime, but there actually have been many successful transitions from authoritarian regimes, whereas with these sort of elected autocrats or autocratic populists, it can actually be harder to bounce back for a number of reasons.
Would you call them avatars that get in and pretend to be genuinely in favour of a democracy, but they get in and they undermine those institutions that keep a check and balance on their power? You've got some examples, haven't you, of people who have a go at the free press, and that gets rid of a lot of criticism against them. Sometimes they change the electoral rules. It makes it easier for them to get elected. Perhaps you can help us and tell us the sorts of things, once they get elected, they set about doing to unwind the democratic protections.
Right. So the difference between a place like Thailand in the period between 2001 and 2014, now Thailand is run by an outright military junta, but in the period when there was a series of sort of autocratic-leaning populists, or in the Berlusconi area, or Hungary now, things like that, you can go to these places and you often don't see the type of very obvious, brutal, outright repression that exists in China, that exists in North Korea, that existed, you know, in the Soviet Union. I mean, some of these places there certainly are very serious problems with repression in the Philippines now, where it's sort of bled over from the drug war. But the rulers don't generally rule through that type of harsh, outright repression. Instead, they change the various natures of the political system that give them an inherent and prolonged advantage. So you can change the constitution to give yourself more and more terms and power, which is something that has been done in Turkey, that has been done in other places. Or you can change the constitution to give the office more power. You can do what we call in the United States gerrymandering.
We use that term here too.
Okay, sorry, I didn't know that. I mean, it's particularly pronounced among Western democracies in the United States. And so, you know, that's used in some places in the U.S. It's not used in every state in the U.S., but certainly in Hungary, it's been used very extensively, so that even when Orban's party doesn't necessarily win majority of the vote, they win massive majorities of seats. And that's a very common tool, packing and undermining the judiciary. And then with the press, again, it's not so much like what we would think of in the past, where there would be outright censors, like in China today, or Soviet Union, where it was like Pravda, or where journalists are being sent to jail or killed. Well, that does definitely happen in places like the Philippines, which is a very dangerous environment for journalists, and in Turkey. But more of the press is manipulated or affected by either the ruler's cronies buy into various media outlets, or the ruler himself could, like Berlusconi did, or they just essentially, there's so much information and misinformation thrown around both by the government and their allies that it just becomes hard for people to understand what's actually true or not. And that is probably the biggest tactic.
I'm talking with Joshua Kolencik from the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States about democratically elected autocrats. Joshua, you're talking about Berlusconi. I was in Italy for the time, some of the time at least, he was there. You know, I don't sort of put him in the same category as Erdogan and the Philippines and that sort of stuff. He certainly controlled the media by virtue of money. Why else would you put him in that category?
Right. Well, there's gradations of everything. You know, I mean, I'm talking about a broad category of people who were elected and had genuine legitimacy from their elections and then did a variety of things to undermine the democratic process, while also most of these people, not all of them, but most of these people could be characterized as populists. They portray themselves as sort of like the tribune of the legitimate people against the illegitimate people, which is sort of a central theme of this. They sort of course in public discourse. And certainly Berlusconi was very, very much doing that. But they don't necessarily all have to be the same. I mean, Duterte is overseeing a massive drug war that is killing tens of thousands of people. And Erdogan has put tens of thousands of people in jail. And Berlusconi's government was certainly not repressive in those ways, but I think it fits a similar pattern in the ways that it does. Is one, Berlusconi and his allies use these similar tactics to control the Italian media, both through dominance of media outlets and through misinformation, making it very hard for people to know what was and wasn't true. Berlusconi and his allies used their power in business and in other ways to apply pressure on the political system that tilted political contests. Berlusconi sort of coarsened public discourse in a way that a lot of these other people like Bolsonaro, Duterte, I mean, we haven't even mentioned him, but Trump did, in which sort of Berlusconi made it so that politics became sort of the theater of the absurd, which is where these folks often
That's
do
a
really
very
well.
Good description of
then
the time.
Finally, I mean, Berlusconi, partly for his own personal reasons, because he was constantly being investigated for both financial allegations and then later for crimes linked to his sex ring, he was constantly trying to undermine the Italian judiciary, which had worked really hard in the 80s and the 90s to sort of cleanse itself and become a very powerful check on both corruption, which was endemic in Italy, and the mafia. And Berlusconi worked really, really hard to roll those reforms back. So I definitely would put Berlusconi in that category. One of the things that happens is once you have one guy, or it could be a woman, but so far we've seen mostly this has been guys, sort of undermine the democratic system like this, it then sort of paves the way for others. So Berlusconi is essentially gone, although he still has, you know, some significant influence. And, you know, in Italy always had its problems, but his undermining of the democratic system has paved the way for an environment in Italy in which other populists, I don't know if they're worse than Berlusconi, but they're doing the same things, have now emerged as the Five Star Movement and the League together in power. And so they are engaging in misinformation and conspiracy theories, more of the same. So he sort of was the virus that infected Italian politics in some ways. And now the host has sort of been infected and wasn't really cured. And the patient is now suffering from other similar viruses.
Well, let's look at an example of Thailand. I think that is a good example of what happens when you get elected autocrats that wreck the system. What can you tell us about that history?
Right. Well, Thailand's a little more complicated. First, you have a sort of elected autocrat with Thaksin Shinawat, who was genuinely popular and won election after election and did have some policies that were quite effective, but didn't really care that much for the rule of law and the judiciary and press and institutions. I mean, it becomes a challenging situation, but the people who oppose Thaksin, instead of trying their best to combat him while upholding the rule of law and trying to restore the rule of law, they then turn to the most aggressive, undemocratic means to oust him. There was a military coup in 2006, and then again recently in 2014. And so what you have is actually probably a worse situation, more polarized and worse situation. And that's a problem you have in other places too, where opponents of these elected autocrats sometimes sort of lost as to what to do, embrace anti-democratic responses to an already sort of very shakily democratic system. So Thailand is now sort of lost. They have a military junta. It's the most repressive junta in decades. They haven't really resolved any of the problems, and their political system is sort of ruined.
Mm. Can I ask you, separate from all the knowledge you have of the different countries and their history, about, I think it might be an intuitive assessment on your part, what Americans think democracy means? I sense that many Australians don't think much more about democracy than, well, we have to go and vote every now and then, and really we don't like politicians. We often say, God, just get on with the job and keep out of our way. But you have a different system in the United States. How do you think it goes there? Is there much discussion there about some of these checks and balances, like freedom of speech, for example?
Obviously, in the last couple of years, there has been, you know, a lot of discussion in the U.S. I wouldn't be here talking probably if a lot of these trends had only been confined to Thailand and the Philippines. I mean, maybe I would, because this is ABC and you have a very global outlook. But there is concern in the U.S. about some of these other aspects, although I think that generally there was probably more discussion in the U.S. of some of these other aspects of democracy than in some other countries in the past, just because they're sort of embedded in the Constitution. Whereas other democracies certainly score much better than the U.S. for actual voting and electoral participation. The actual number of people voting in the U.S. is very small compared to Australia, where, yes, I know it's compulsory, but the turnout figures are staggering. You know, I mean, we just had a midterm where people are talking about it having extremely high turnout, which is true in the U.S. context, but it would still be, in the context of any other major democracy, it would be staggeringly low. I think that in general, the people in the U.S. who do think about these things think about more than voting, because the way that the U.S. Constitution is written, some of the key amendments that are sort of talked about and discussed in the context of the political system do get quite a lot of discussion and hearing in political life. And certainly now there's a very antagonistic relationship between the press and the president. So the First Amendment gets talked about, but even before that, it's talked about a lot. And some of the other amendments get talked about a fair amount, as well as some of the other parts of the Constitution. And we do have, you know, quite a lot more political maneuvering and politicking around our Supreme Court than is common in most other Western democracies, where the top court tends to be very technocratic and either completely immune from politics or mostly immune. So I think that there is more discussion of other aspects of sort of living in democracy in the U.S., even before this current period where it's become very fraught, than there probably is in some other countries. But unfortunately, when it comes to the actual voting, the U.S. just really seriously is an outlier among, you know, wealthy OECD countries.
Joshua Kolancic from the Council on Foreign Relations, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.